This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Private employers added jobs in July.
So then, is it safe to let taxes go up?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, August 4th. Private employers reportedly added 42,000 jobs last month. Now, if hiring is coming back a little, does it mean the economy could withstand higher taxes on the wealthy?
BP says its oil plug is working, which is what Gulf of Mexico shrimpers would like to do. That's coming up, and a presidential wedding that could foster some new real estate talking points. But first,
let's say good morning to our Wednesday regular, economist Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research, joins us live from Washington. Morning, Richard.
Good morning, Bill.
This morning, the payroll company ADP said private employers added 42,000 jobs in July. Isn't that a little better than expected?
Well, it is, and I'd call it encouraging. You know, we've had softness in the months of May and June, and there's been a lot of speculation. Is this the start of a double dip or extended weakness? But today's latest report puts a mark in the column of temporary soft patch. So it's far from conclusive, but I think July is getting off to a better start than we've seen over the late spring months.
Okay, so you think we might be avoiding a double dip. I wonder then how you react to this morning's call from the Treasury Secretary. Tim Geithner says we should let the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy expire this coming January. Now, Richard, some economists say that would suck us back into recession.
Well, I actually agree with the Treasury Secretary on this one, and I'll reference some work that was done, some very fine work by a company in St. Louis, Missouri, called Macro Advisors. They say if we rescind all the Bush tax cuts, it will in fact take a heavy toll on the economy, subtracting about a percentage point from GDP growth next year. That's tough, but if we take a baby step and just trim those that Tim Geithner was talking about, we'll only be losing a tenth or two from GDP growth. Now, everyone agrees that we need to do something about the deficit, and most people agree that it can't all be done with cost cutting. So the question is how and when we raise taxes, and I think a partial expiration of the Bush tax cuts starting in January would probably be a good start.
Okay. Economist Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Intel today settled a major antitrust case with the Federal Trade Commission. The world's biggest chip maker was accused of shutting smaller rivals out of the market, keeping chip prices unfairly high. Now, today's deal would be a major milestone given the U.S. isn't Intel's only antitrust critic. Roger Kay is founder of information technology research firm Endpoint Technologies Associates. He's with us live from Malta, New York. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Steve.
Give us some details of this settlement. I mean, how does this deal change the way Intel does business?
Well, essentially, Steve, this settlement constrains Intel's behavior a little bit. There are no financial penalties in it. But essentially, Intel has to manage its discounting policies in such a manner that it doesn't totally preclude rivals from getting business.
Now, this is the settlement, Roger, with the FTC, but there are other antitrust allegations that Intel is having to defend. Is this a game changer?
Well, yes, because the FTC suit was one of the largest that remained out. Probably the worst of Intel's woes comes from Europe, where they had to pay a fine. That is currently in appeal. It's a more than a $1 billion fine, and they're trying to get that rescinded. But in the meantime, they have troubles in Korea. They have some in Japan. But many of the private suits have been settled already here in the United States, and Intel has actually got a good record of settling these suits one at a time.
Settling? I mean, they just settled by doing what they did today.
Well, they do that. In the case of AMD, it's their main rival. They actually had to pay them $1.2 billion and sign some agreement. So the settlement with them was a little more costly. But yes, they've been working these one at a time and gradually clearing away the constraints for them to continue to compete.
AMD being the other chipmaker, Advanced Micro Devices, right?
Right.
Yeah. Now, will this make computers cheaper, Roger?
You know, I actually don't think it's going to have much of an effect on the cost of computers. I mean, you would think it might, but the discounting policies that Intel undertakes are very complex, and the disputes between Intel and AMD and other players in the market, they're just Byzantine. They take up far more space than we have here. But effectively, I think that the prices are going to be pretty much the same as they have been.
All right. Roger Kay, founder of information technology research firm Endpoint Technologies Associates, joining us from New York. Roger, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, August 4th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. BP says its latest move to cork the Gulf oil leak is working so far. Engineers are getting ready to permanently plug the well with cement. And Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us the damage from the oil might be less than feared.
Three-quarters of the record-breaking 5 million barrels of oil spilled into the Gulf is already gone. That's according to government scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The credit goes to skimmers and burn-offs, chemical dispersants, and Mother Nature, says Peter Kemp of Petroleum Intelligence Weekly.
What we're seeing now in terms of these very encouraging figures about the amount of oil which has either been collected, dispersed, or broken down naturally in the warm waters of the Gulf puts the overall long-term impact of the spill in a rather different perspective.
This might trim BP's bill for cleanup and compensation going forward. Much of the Gulf is already open to fishing again, and most beaches are clear of oil, at least on the surface. But government scientists point out 25% of the oil is still out there somewhere, sunk into sand and sediment or floating around as tar balls, where it could affect marine life and the fishing and tourism industries for years to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Louisiana officials will meet to set the start of the fall shrimping season in the Gulf. It is a big step toward normal in a year that's been anything but. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more.
Traditionally, fishermen get the go-ahead to start the fall shrimping season, the third Monday of August. And even though a lot of the fishing waters are still closed because of the spill, Martin Bourgeois with the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries says it's a big deal.
Setting this fall season date is time to get our fishermen back to work, doing what they do best. It's important to these fishing communities that the fishery stays profitable.
But Danny Babin, who manages a shrimp processing facility in Louisiana, doubts that all that many shrimpers are champing at the bit to get back out there. He says a whole lot of them and their boats are out working cleanup, getting paid a good wage by BP.
They're getting paid so much per day. When you go shrimping, if you don't catch any shrimp, you don't make any money. If you catch a bumper crop, you make money. So, I mean, it's a gamble.
By working for BP, Babin says, the fishermen have a guaranteed paycheck, something that can be hard to turn down right now. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, August 4th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us in the United States. All this week, banks in Europe are reporting how well their business is doing, and on the whole, it's a similar story to the United States. And while the rest of the economy staggers on, the financial institutions seem to be staging a stronger recovery. The BBC's Rebecca Singer checks it out for Marketplace.
They're the types of losses we'd got used to hearing from the banks, but $2, $3 and even $11 billion are the profits some of Europe's biggest banks have racked up in the past 6 months. Peter McNamara has worked in key positions at some of the UK's biggest banks.
Banks tend to do well when the economy is growing, so seeing the banks going on the other side is some indication of that recovery underway.
But there's another side to the story. Unemployment in Europe and the US is still high, and governments are pressuring banks to loan money to small businesses to help them grow. Eric Daniels is chief executive of Lloyds Banking Group, which is 41% owned by the British taxpayer. He says money is available, it's just that demand from small business owners isn't there.
You don't see a lot of expansion, and therefore you don't see a lot of financing needs. Many of our customers are very prudent, and they are, in fact, drawing down debt.
But some analysts believe that a recovery is only possible if banks pump money back into the economy. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
In Pakistan, floodwaters continue to flow through the country, which have destroyed buildings and killed more than 1,500 people. The monsoonal flooding is being called the worst in modern Pakistan history, mainly because the high water hit in the country's agricultural heartland, destroying crops and leaving the country vulnerable to food shortages. Neva Khan is with the aid organization Oxfam, and she's with us on the phone from Islamabad. Neva, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What are you seeing on the ground over there?
We're seeing over 3 million people who are at the moment affected by floods, and this number is going to go up.
Obviously, the recovery, Neva, is ongoing over there. What are the lasting economic effects these floods will cause?
I think it's very hard to say exactly what will be the economic impact, except to say the requirements for the flood-affected areas of Pakistan are going to be extensive. We're talking about, you know, bridges needing to be rebuilt. We're talking about people having to have the resources to rebuild their lives. This is going to be a very, very large-scale, extremely expensive operation. It's going to take a long time for the country to move forwards on.
What's the best way to help a country in this situation? I mean, do you just send money?
I think the best way for everyday people at the moment is anything that they can spare, because I know things are very hard in America at the moment, as well as in Europe and everywhere else. Whatever people can afford to give, I think the people of Pakistan will certainly be very grateful.
I know, Neva, Pakistan and the United States are already spending so much money, billions of dollars, in the fight against terrorism in those areas. Are these disasters just spreading that regional aid much thinner?
Certainly. And you will know that the U.S. government has committed to $5 billion over the next 5 years. However, I was talking with somebody only yesterday, and they were trying to explain to me how, they'd gone through the various problems with the militancy. And they said, well, you know, Neva, it's now. This flood has had a bigger impact on our lives than anything before, because now people have lost their homes. You know, this is an extensive problem for people and for the government of Pakistan and the humanitarian community.
Neva Khan with the aid organization Oxfam, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Maybe you know a little something about this. You walk into a store, you do some shopping, right? But a long line sends you right back out the door. Well, here's something you may not know. Unlike in the United States, the British have long had a reputation of being very content to stand in line, thank you. But as Christopher Worth reports from London, a new study today reports that patience in Britain is wearing thin.
The study out from the bank Barclays says the British are becoming less willing to wait for what they want. But before we get into that, first let's take care of some linguistic differences. While the Americans stand in a line, the British stand in a queue. But whatever you call it, and however boring it might be, people in Britain are really good at it.
I think the joke about the British is that, we see one person standing still, then immediately we'll go and stand behind them. We won't know what we're queuing for, but we know it must be good.
Ian H. is an author and commentator on British culture. He says some of that comes from the old traditional double-decker buses that only had one door and one line to get on. But the study shows the length of time the average British person is willing to wait has dropped from 5 minutes just 6 years ago to 2 minutes today. H. credits the change to the internet. Brits used to shop after waiting in line. Now they simply shop online. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. A war on plastic bags began 3 years ago in San Francisco when the city banned the bags from big supermarkets and chain drugstores. Now, San Francisco might expand the ban to cover all retailers, as April Demboski reports.
The ban would mainly impact small business owners, but not all of them are against it. Dan Macarini owns a jewelry store and heads the North Beach Merchants Association. It's a group of about 65 local businesses. He says giving up plastic wouldn't be a big burden in the long run.
Initially it would. Like, I would have to get rid of some plastic bags here that I put jewelry or sculpture into, and I would have to replace those, but I don't think it's a huge expense.
But the American Chemistry Council opposes the expansion of the ban. Sherry Jackson is with the group's plastics division. She said she'd rather see the city focus on recycling programs.
We work with and encourage jurisdictions to take that approach, as opposed to less consumer-friendly approach of bans and taxes.
California may get even more anti-plastic. The legislature is now considering the country's first statewide ban on plastic bags. In San Francisco, I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
It's summer travel season, and the roaming is easy. Too easy, in fact. Here with a story of smartphones gone wild overseas is Los Angeles Times business columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have a cautionary tale of a roaming midshipman.
In this case, he's a Navy ROTC midshipman. He goes on a training mission to Guam. He arrives. He sends an email to his superior officer saying, hey, I'm here, and forgets to turn off the roaming feature on his smartphone, which means the email and all the rest is going to keep downloading into the unit. He comes back to Southern California, and hello, there's a $1,300 bill waiting for him from Verizon.
Happened automatically. He wasn't calling people overseas. This must happen a lot. Don't cell providers give you a break when that happens? You made a mistake.
They will oftentimes waive at least a portion of the bill, but it's a serious problem. In fact, in May, the FCC stepped up and said, we're seeing increasing cases of what they call bill shock, of people suddenly encountering these multi-$1,000 bills on their wireless accounts, primarily because teenagers are texting themselves silly and mom and dad have no idea how these bills are mounting up. So government officials want to crack down on this. The cell phone companies say we're sympathetic, but we don't think we need to go too far on the regulatory front.
Well, How hard is it? They could send you a text message, right?
Precisely, Bill. In fact, that's what the Europeans do. They will send you a text message when you're starting to go over the limits on your plan. They'll even cut you off if you're going over. It seems to me that what we need to be doing here is just simply more transparency about the usage. The cell phone companies say, look, if you want to find out how much data you're using, all you got to do is go online or call us. You do have the tools. This is true.
Grow up and learn how to use your cell phone.
Yeah, and there's a point to that. On the other hand, and a lot of people just aren't going to be very proactive, especially if they're on vacation. So why don't we just simply have text messages going out at regular intervals saying, first of all, you're roaming. Second of all, hello, $100 right there. Try and nip it in the bud. Moreover, if you're on a family plan, mom and dad, the account holder, need to be alerted also. And why not this? Why not allow mom and dad to cap usage? If you go over a certain point, let's say $100 or $500 in data downloads, boom, you're cut off.
Kids, who do you think you are traveling overseas anyway? You're too young. LA Times business columnist David Lazarus, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And finally, it was a joyous occasion last weekend for the Clinton family as former first daughter Chelsea married her hedge fund manager fiancé.
But Steve, you got to wonder if the joy really goes to the owners of the estate where that wedding took place.
Mm.
Astor Courts has been up for sale since last September at an asking price of $12 million. Sotheby's had the real estate contract through the end of last month. But now the owners are selling it themselves.
So given the presidential affair that took place last weekend, something tells me Astor will be employing some new marketing ploys.
I think it would fit nicely.
There you go. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.